Okay, today is November 21st, 2011. This is an interview with Jill Hopke. Is that how you say your last
name?
Hopke. We're here in the conference room on the fourth floor of Steenbuck Library inside the UW-Madison Archives. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we are doing this interview specifically for a project we call Capitol Protests 2011. Thank you for coming today. The first question doesn't have much to do, unless you choose to answer it this way, with the protests of 2011. This is to give us a little bit of a context of your life, if you wouldn't mind talking about your early years and even your undergraduate, if you want. Try to bring us up to your time coming here to UW-Madison.
Okay. Well, that's a big question. I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and I guess it, in some ways I'll give you some background that does relate to the Capitol protests. Both of my parents are teachers. Both of them are retired now, and my stepfather worked at the University of Minnesota in a facilities management position. He wasn't a faculty member. But I grew up in the Twin Cities, and you know, I do remember when I was very young that my mother was very involved in her union. And I hear other people mention that, you know, as a reason for an involvement in unionism, because of course the union movement is not that strong now in the United States, but having parents that were involved in unions. And so I grew up in the Twin Cities, and both my parents were teachers, and so education was always a very big focus in my life growing up. And, you know, my mom really emphasized that I would go to college one day. And so I actually did my undergraduate degree here as well at the University of Wisconsin. And I moved here originally in 1998. I did 1 year as a post-secondary student, my last year of high school, in Minnesota State University, Mankato, closer to home, and then decided to come here for a whole variety of reasons. But it was a much better school. You know, I got accepted. And it was close to home. There's tuition remission between Wisconsin and Minnesota. A lot of the financial considerations, which I think are much more present for students now, given the cost of attending the university has gone up significantly in the decade or so since I did my undergraduate degree here. But I finished my undergrad degree in 2002. And so I had lived in Madison, you know, as an undergraduate student, and then stayed off and on after I finished my undergraduate degree. Do you want me to go into more detail about
that? Yeah, if you don't
that?
Mind, that's great. Let me, if you don't mind, we'll ask some follow-up questions mm-hmm. about that and go from there. So, where did your mother teach?
My mom taught for the St. Paul School District. I actually don't know the official name of it, mm-hmm. but she taught in St. Paul, and for about 3 years, she's now retired. But she worked first as a teacher, a special education teacher with deaf and hard of hearing students, and then she went on. She was she filled in temporarily as an assistant principal and found that she liked that aspect. So she finished out her career in administration. She was a principal of an elementary school in St. Paul for the last probably, I would say, 6 or 7 years of her career.
Mm-hmm. And you may have mentioned this or even alluded to it in that introduction, but so you went to, you finished high school and college, basically? Is that, you did your last year of, or did you already have your high school diploma and you did a year at Mankato State?
You know, I don't know if Wisconsin has a similar program, but Minnesota, at the time that I was in high school, had a program where you could go to college for your last 2 years of your high school, your junior and senior year, and the state or the school district would pay for your tuition and books. And you had to return your books. I mean, they were owned by the school, you know, but then you would pay room and board. Most people go somewhere kind of close. So, you know, I lived in the Twin Cities. My stepsister was a student at Mankato Minnesota State University Mankato. They changed the name since I went there, so I'm trying to use the new name. But my sister went there, and she was a couple years ahead of me, so that's how the idea kind of came about that I could go there as well, you know, since my sister would be there. And so I essentially skipped my senior year of high school and did this called post-secondary program and went there my senior year. So I technically graduated from high school in the spring of 1998, but I had spent that academic year at college in Mankato. And I went back home for high school graduation.
Okay. Have you reflected on how you feel that basically doing your senior year at a college either benefited you or perhaps maybe didn't benefit you as you moved on or have moved on?
That's an interesting question. I think that on the whole, it benefited me. Academically, I wasn't that engaged with high school in the end. I did well in high school, but I didn't like the environment of being in high school. It felt a lot like being in prison to me. And so it was a tremendous freedom to be able to go away to college, you know, when you're 17, and make friends. And, I lived in a dorm. And it was actually a very different experience from then coming here and essentially doing a second freshman year here at Wisconsin. It's a small university. It's a state school. There's nowhere near the amount of extracurricular activities there than there were here and still are here. Sororities and fraternities are also big here, but you know, that would be, as far as social activities, one of the only social activities on the weekend might be to go to a party. The end of that year, I got a little bit involved in helping organize some campus events. And it's also another big cultural difference between Mankato and here in Madison is it's a dry campus. You know, I know Wisconsin is very unique that it is a wet campus where you can buy alcohol in the student unions. So, you know, I helped a little bit with organizing some music shows in the student union in Mankato. And nobody would go. You know, nobody would hang out in the union on a Friday night because, you don't have the component of being able to buy alcohol in your student union. So it wasn't a cool place. Like, the university campus was not a cool place to hang out. It was not known for having anything fun to go on in the weekend. And Mankato is also very much a commuter campus for people that commute. So the vast majority of students would leave on the weekends and go home to Twin Cities or other areas. So the big night to go out would have been a Thursday. So the culture was very different. One thing that I did really like about Mankato was I lived in a dorm my freshman year that was all freshmen. It was an all freshman dorm. And so it was easier, I guess, to make friends. It was with people that were going through that same experience as you, of being away from home for the first time, being a first-year student. And so I really liked the environment, the environment for making friends, of living in a dorm that was all freshmen. And then coming here, I was in a situation where I'd already done one freshman year, and made friends. And so, it was a little bit challenging to kind of essentially do that all over again. I found coming here to, a campus of 40,000 students, more than 40,000 students to be, it was a pretty significant shift. And academically, it was a shift too. In Mankato, everything was very easy for the most part. And I was like the top student in all of my classes by far, with the exception of an algebra class I took, actually. And maybe Spanish was difficult. But, for the most part, there was definitely an academic shift as well. That academics here were more challenging. And then, I had a couple of friends from my high school that came here. A lot of students do come to Wisconsin for school because of the reciprocity between the two states. And so, I had some friends here coming here, but it was a very overwhelming experience to go from a very small state college to the flagship university in Wisconsin.
Did you have any time during that first semester, that first year, that you felt like you had made a mistake by coming to UW-Madison? Mistake's kind of a harsh term, but, at least entertained thoughts about why you came here and maybe whether that was the right the right choice for you or not?
You know, I think I always kind of felt that it was the right choice academically. You know, socially, it was hard to feel like, you know, I had made a group of friends when I had been in school in Mankato, and then to leave that environment, and it was challenging to make friends here. I lived in Salary Hall, one of the Southeast dorms. And actually, I'm still in touch with some friends that I met my second year, my freshman year here, I guess. So it was hard, you know, so I was a freshman again, but not really. So that kind of mental process of having been kind of like, oh, but I went through this all once already, was kind of jarring. And then, you know, the academics were a lot more challenging here. So that was an adjustment as well. And, you know, there were times when, you know, I had one friend from high school, her name was Stephanie, and we would be like, we don't have any other friends, you know, but we started making friends and branching out. You know, when you're 18, you can be kind of overly dramatic about a lot of things, and so I'm sure there were moments when I regretted it, but, you know, on the whole, by the end of the year of 1998, 1999, when I was here, you know, I started getting involved in some activities on campus, and it took a while to make that transition, which is probably something that a lot of transfer students, more traditional transfer students, go through when they come here.
Okay. So obviously didn't know that you went to undergraduate here, which means obviously I'm not sure of what your major was. So I want to ask it this way, though. When you came here, did you know what you wanted to major in? If so, talk about that. If not, if you talk about the process of sort of finding your way through academically to your major.
You know, I didn't know what I wanted to major in. I had worked on my high school newspaper when I was in high school, called The Odyssey, and it was actually part of a class. There was an instrumental English teacher who, you know, I had taken an AP English class, and then, you know, there was also an option to take the student newspaper as a class, which I think, you know, in reflection now, is one of the things that can make something like that, is partly extracurricular but partly academic, you know, successful. So I had worked on my high school newspaper, and I do know my parents and other people were asking me, you know, if I was going to go in the direction of doing media work. And at the time, I always said no, and I actually majored in international relations with an emphasis in environmental studies. They've changed the degree requirements around since I did the degree. It's now an international studies degree, but I got a degree in international relations with an emphasis in managing the global commons. So I did take a number of classes in what is now the Nelson Institute.
Just finishing writing that down. So what were some of the you talked about taking classes sort of through or with the Nelson Institute. Were there specific classes that that stand out in your mind, either for good reasons or perhaps not so good reasons?
There is one. It was the class I took my first semester, and it was their introductory course in kind of humanities perspective on environmental studies, and you know, I would have to go back and look at the name of the professor. It was a woman professor. I can look it up, you know who taught that class. And, you know, it's one of the classes that stands out for me. We read a book about wolves, you know, about history of wolves in Wisconsin and conservation. And it was a different way to look at the environment, I guess, you know, looking at, you know, science. You know, you can come from a very biological science perspective, but then coming from this more ecological and humanities studies perspective, definitely is something that sticks with me now. And I also remember it was a class that was actually, I remember there being a few graduate students in the class, and then so we had a discussion, you know, lecture, and then a discussion section with a TA, and I do remember one discussion that we had where we were talking about, you know, food choices that you make, you know, so where you choose to shop, for example, versus at a grocery store, or, you know, I had before then not been at all familiar with food cooperatives, and of course in Madison we have several, and the tensions. And I remember one of the other students who was a graduate student saying, you know, well, I'm a graduate student and I can't afford to buy all this expensive organic food, or talking about those tensions between, you know, living your ideals and, you know, economic realities, particularly when you're on your own and you're supporting yourself. So that's one discussion that we had in that class that sticks out in my mind. So that one, I took Bill Cronin's American Environmental History course. So that's another class that's affiliated with the Nelson Institute that stands out for me as well. I took that a couple years later. Let's see, those are the two that I can think of right now that really stand out.
Okay. Since you did go to undergraduate here, were there, I wouldn't necessarily say extracurricular, but sort of campus-based activities or groups that you became involved in while you were here?
I, you know, the second semester of my first year got involved with WISPRG, one of the campus groups. I wasn't involved with WISPRG that much beyond my first year, but, you know, so I was involved with WISPRG for a little bit. My first year is kind of an introduction into environmental activist type activities. And then I remember going to an Earth Day fair on campus. So that would have been, of course, April 22nd, you know, so towards the end of my first year, and being introduced to the group, the UW Greens. They used to run the UW Greens Info Shop on campus. It's now the Madison Info Shop, and it's off campus on Willie Street. But it used to be an SSFC-funded student group. This would have been in, like, the spring of 1999. So I was mostly involved with the UW Greens. So starting at the very end of my first year, and then my second year here, so my junior and senior year. You know, so then for the next couple years, I was pretty involved with the UW Greens, and I worked at the UW Greens Info Shop.
Could you talk a little bit more about the UW Greens? Honestly, I've never heard of that before. So I'm wondering if you could talk about, you know, what their mission was and how you worked to help with that.
Sure. It's a social justice group. You know, there was always a lot of confusion about the UW Greens. And of course, this was right around 2000 when Ralph Nader ran for president and the Green Party. And it's actually not a group that was affiliated whatsoever with the Green Party. But I do remember that we went, so I was on staff for a year, maybe a year and a half. And we used to have an office in what was University Square, the old University Square. So we had an office in there. And it just run as kind of a multi-purpose social justice center, I guess I would say. And this was before the Red Gym opened or reopened. And then all of the kind of multicultural groups moved in there. Of course, Mecha still has their space on University. But it was a similar kind of organization to kind of what Mecha does. So, you know, we did different kinds of campaigns, like around food, for example, and fair trade. And like, I remember at one point making a fact sheet about Cargill and industrial agriculture, and then got really involved with around like in 2000 and 2001, the anti-sweatshop campaign. And of course, this is when David Ward was the chancellor for the first time. There was a sit-in at Bascom Hall, where students and community members got arrested protesting, you know, for fair trade, you know, in making university apparel. So that was something that UW Greens was very involved with, and that was around the time that the Workers' Rights Consortium started, such as a national group, which is a national organization that's pushing for fair trade practices and worker justice for people who are working in factories that produce university apparel. So that was around the time that campaign was getting started on campus. So that was run out of the UW Greens Info Shop. So that's giving you a sense of the kinds of, you know, social justice and economic justice kinds of issues that we worked on.
So were you directly involved in the sit-in?
A little bit. I worked at the Info Shop at that time, and so it served as a meeting space and kind of an information space for coordination around that. That was also the time around I started getting involved with WORT, the community radio station here in town. And so during the actual sit-in, I was taking more of a journalistic role, like journalist activist kind of role and covering the protests for the community radio station. So that would have been the winter of 2000. And so I didn't get arrested at that protest, but I was there throughout and interviewing people and then producing reports for the community radio station and also working at the info shop and taking more of a support role.
Okay. I want to ask at least one more question about your undergraduate time, because there's a, I think we can safely say, a seminal event that happened during your undergraduate time, and that's 9/11. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your memories of finding out about 9/11 and what, if anything, you did in the aftermath in terms of any sort of campus event that went on.
Well, so that was obviously a fall of 2001, and I had mentioned that I had been volunteering at the community radio station, WORT, and so what I ended up doing was I started working there as their news and public affairs director. And during, I was first interim news and public affairs director during the summer of 2001, and then was hired. The economic climate was so different back in 2001, before September 11th and before economic crash and recession that we find ourselves in now. So the fact that I was actually able to get that job, being 20 years old and not having finished college, like, it would never happen now. I mean, hearing how many people have applied for that position in subsequent times that it's been open, I don't think I wouldn't have had, it was a unique opportunity to have, you know. So I was actually hired for a full-time position at WORT towards the end of the summer of 2001. And so I just had started the permanent position around August and September of 2001. And so I was taking one, so my plan was to take one class each semester. I was 6 credits shy, because I came in with a bunch of credits when I came here, because I had gone done post-secondary in Mankato. And so I would have graduated early. You know, I had 6 credits to go, but then I had this opportunity to have this full-time job. And so I decided I would take one class each semester to finish my degree, because it does seem silly to drop out of college when you have 6 credits to graduation. So I was taking a multicultural women's literature class that fall with Nellie McKay, and that was actually another class that really sticks with me as well. So I had one class, so I went to class, I think it was twice a week, and so I was supposed to have class, that morning, so I was basically working full-time, but 2 mornings a week I would go to class. And so I remember I was living in a housing co-op then, and I remember waking up, and so I was working at a radio station, so I listened to the radio all the time. So I remember waking up and starting listening to the morning show on WORT, and all of the programming is produced by volunteers. And so the host, Dan Woodard, it was a Tuesday, so he was on the air. No, and I think what had happened was people were starting to call in. And I also didn't have a television then, so, you know, most people probably learned about that event through television, but I was actually listening to the radio. And then heard, you know, first the host broke in and said, "We're hearing reports that something happened in New York." And then a few minutes later, you know, announcing things as they were happening. And, you know, I first thought, well, I have to go to class. This, you know, I'm supposed to have class at 9:30. I have to go to class. And then, you know, so that would have been like the 8 to 9 o'clock hour as things were happening in New York, you know. And then I decided, well, I can't go to class. I have to just go straight to work, obviously. So I emailed the professor. I think actually I emailed her in the evening or later in the day to explain why I hadn't been in class. You know, so I ended up going straight to the radio station, and we spent the entire day doing special programming from the BBC and Democracy Now! Program that was then part of WBAI in New York, but it's now an independent news production, but it's part of Pacifica Radio Network, which is a lefty, more social justice-oriented version of NPR, I guess you could say. And so we were airing special programming and throughout the day and just kind of on the fly as things were developing. You know, so I didn't actually go to class that day, and you know, I mostly spent most of my time in those weeks right after September 11th at the radio station and coordinating the programming. You know, WORT is such a unique community resource. Particularly then, you can remember back in 2001, this was before the social media phenomenon, and so there wasn't Twitter, there wasn't Facebook, which it's amazing to think in 10 years how our media environments have been, and the way that we interact socially has been so completely revolutionized. But, you know, I remember taking phone calls from people that would call us up and say, you know, so the station is based in Madison, but its listening area is most of South Central Wisconsin and doesn't reach to Milwaukee. But, you know, taking phone calls from people that were calling and saying, you know, this is the only voice of reason, you know, in my community, you know, out in the listening area outside of Madison. And so just seeing what an important medium a community radio station was at that point in time for helping provide alternative perspectives. You know, I feel like the news coverage and the national tone as a whole in that period right after September 11th was very nationalistic and very much out for revenge. You know, the U.S. then invaded Afghanistan very shortly thereafter in October of 2001. And so being a force for, you know, or a community, a space for dialogue and airing of perspectives that are saying, you know, even in this time of crisis, even in response to this horrific act of terrorism, you know, there could still be space to talk about peace and justice. And the way that it served as a community resource, both in terms of news and public affairs programming, but also in terms of music and culture, and really seeing what an important resource that was. So that was what I spent most of my time doing in that period. You know, I was taking one class then, but I wasn't super linked into the university community as a whole. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, we had some discussions in my class about it, and you know, and I remember getting an email back from my professor saying, you know, oh, it was fine that I missed class, and that the class that I ended up spending the whole time talking about what had happened in New York anyway.
And we may, as we go along here, we may sort of talk about the post 9/11 world as we talk about some of these other things. So I assume you did graduate in the spring. Mm-hmm. Of what would then be 2002.
Yes, I graduated in May of 2002.
At that point, what were your future plans?
Well, at that point, I definitely did not plan to go to graduate school. I was working at the radio station. I had taken an urban and regional planning class the spring semester, and I did almost not take a class the spring semester. It was very overwhelming to work somewhere like WORT in a period, in a post September 11th period, and the way the world changed and U.S. politics and foreign policy changed so significantly. And, you know, first the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq, you know, subsequently in 2003, you know, so it was a difficult period to also juggle all of that with being a student. But I had several friends that very wisely advised me that it would be, you know, to just take another class and get it out of the way, because at that point, certainly it would have been harder to come back, and I only needed 3 credits to graduate. So I did end up taking a class that spring semester in 2002 and graduating in May of that year. And, you know, at that point, you know, I was working at the radio station, and I worked there for about another year and a half. And I was getting more involved with independent media. And so I kind of saw myself going in that direction. And I told you earlier that I had majored in international relations. And it was a really interesting degree to have. But again, it was the kind of degree where there's no clear career path, which is something my mother reminded me of many times as an undergraduate student, or asked me many times what I was going to do with that degree. And so, you know, that's a challenging thing for a university, right, is you're providing students with a breadth at the undergraduate level, with a breadth of exposure to different ideas and theories and the whole liberal arts education as a whole, but we now live in a society that's increasingly geared towards outcomes and being able to say, I have this degree and I can do X with it, which I think is a challenge facing the university system as a whole. The way that we think about higher education is beginning to shift. So I continued working at WRT, and I wouldn't say that I had a clear career path in mind, to be honest, but I was very passionate about community media and independent media, particularly in a post-September 11th context, and the importance of having alternative views in news, and kind of the empowerment processes along with having those kinds of community spaces.
Okay. So when did graduate school start to become more than an idea but an actuality?
Well, in 2004, I left working at WORT, and I went down to El Salvador for 6 months and volunteered. And I was primarily teaching English at a social justice-focused language school or community organization, NGO, in San Salvador. But at the time, I also visited some community radio stations because that's an interest of mine. And there's one radio station, it's called Radio Victoria, and it's in the northern region of El Salvador called Cabañas. And WRT actually has had a more of a longstanding relationship with this community radio station in El Salvador. And we had some staff from that station, it's mostly run by youth, come and visit us before I left for El Salvador. So I went and spent some time there, not a whole lot. You know, I wasn't so confident about my Spanish skills. So I did spend most of my time living in San Salvador, which is the capital. But it was really pivotal to visit that community radio station in rural El Salvador and see what a force it was in that community, and also see how, in many ways, how similar it was to what we were doing at WRT in Madison. And you know, I remember observing a literature show on Radio Victoria, and it was like all of the microphones except for one were broken. So the host and the guest were both like huddled around one microphone, like reading literature. And it really, it struck me to so similar to WRT, just in the feel and the philosophy and the community building functions that served. And seeing that in more of in a global South context, in rural, more underdeveloped areas of the world. And so I spent some time there in 2004, and then when I came back originally from El Salvador in the end of summer of 2004, I started I had a couple part-time jobs, one of which was in a temp position at Wisconsin Public Radio. So I continued working in media, and I went back in 2005 for a month and spent more time there, and then did interviews and became more interested in, you know, how community radio works in a development state context. And so that was when I first started getting the idea of coming to graduate school and thinking about, you know, how I would be interested in researching something like that. But also the teaching, and I found it really gratifying to have, you know, this experience of cultural exchange with people, you know, that had been doing something similar to me, but in a very different context. And I also, through my work at WRT, really enjoyed teaching, the informal teaching and providing instruction and running workshops. And so I thought that I would like, started to think about how I would like to go to graduate school to teach and also research something that I'm passionate about, you know, professionally. And so that was in 2005. And I didn't come back to graduate school until the fall of 2007, but that was when I started thinking about it.
And I will officially ask why, of all the graduate schools you possibly could have gone to, why UW-Madison?
So I ended up coming back to school for journalism, and I got my master's from the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, though I'm now doing my PhD in the Department of Life Sciences Communication in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. You know, it's one of the top programs in the country, and it's here in Madison. You know, I wish I had a more flowery reason for saying why I came here. You know, there are a lot of reasons. I was accepted. It's a good program. You know, it's here in town. So those would be the main reasons. And it ended up being a really good fit with what I wanted to do. But I did find the process of researching graduate schools to be difficult. I mean, I don't come from a family, like my mom had gone back to school, you know, when she became a principal. But I don't come from a family where that many people have gone to graduate school. And so it wasn't something that was very intuitive to me. And so the process of navigating, taking the GRE, researching schools and figuring out what were good schools and looking at various rankings, Like, I feel like it's something, like, you don't really understand academia until you're in it, and being an undergraduate student is vastly different, you know, and having gone to the same university as an undergraduate student, as a graduate student, I can say the experience is totally different. So that's how I ended up coming back here for graduate school.
Okay. You alluded to this, too, but I'm going to ask it directly. So it appears from what you said that being here in Madison had something to do with it, too. So my question is, what is it about the city or the area that you obviously enjoy enough that you wanted to stay here for graduate school?
I really like so many things about Madison. Having a space like WRT, which, you know, I was very involved with, different kinds of, like, I was also involved with WYOU, the community television station. After I had been doing radio for a while, I decided to try out video. So the different kinds of independent community arts and media type organizations. I did some work or was involved a little bit with Wiskino, which is an independent filmmaking collaborative. I wasn't involved in organizing it at all, but they used to have monthly screenings. So there are a lot of those kinds of opportunities here in Madison. For a city its size, it has quite a bit of cultural offerings.
Okay. So you mentioned in your mind that undergraduate here is vastly different than graduate school here. Do you have examples that stand out in your mind to answer a question if I ask you why?
Sure. Well, you know, I mentioned to you that I did my undergraduate degree in international relations, which is a very, and I can't speak to how it's set up now, but the way that there were four tracks, and some of them were area studies, and there was one that was like an international business focus one, and then I did an environmental focus one. So of any department, you know, I took a number of classes through the Nelson Institute, which also is made, you know, is very interdisciplinary and has lots of different perspectives coming into it as well. So that even in itself isn't one department. But, you know, I was taking a lot of different classes in different areas, so I didn't feel that I had one department that was an academic home. Like, when I was trying to think about applying to graduate school, it was hard to come up with a list of professors that I could ask. And it wasn't because I didn't do well as an undergraduate student, but because of the interdisciplinary nature of that degree, I would take one class here, one class in agriculture economics, one class in biology, you know, another class that was in, you know, the core environmental studies class, environmental history in the history department. And so I didn't have one program that I felt that I was really part of. And I think this is something that the university struggles with as a whole, is, you know, how to provide coherence for undergraduate students and academic advising for undergraduate students. But then coming back as a graduate student and being in one program, you know, working very closely with professors and developing kind of a mentor-mentee relationship, both in the journalism school and also in life sciences communication, where you're taking most of your classes in that department and you're kind of an apprentice, an intellectual apprentice, and you're being mentored into how to, and socialized into how to become an academic, and there are more resources available to you and more attention as a graduate student, that I found the experience to be very different. And that there are a lot more resources for graduate students. And, you know, this is a lot, my experience was very shaped by what I chose as a major. Mm-hmm. You know, I see the undergraduate students in life sciences communication, for example, which is a very small department on campus. And I imagine had I majored in something like that, you know, like what my degree is now as an undergraduate, that my experience probably would have been totally different.
So who was it in the School of Journalism that you were their his or her intellectual apprentice?
Well, my master's advisor is Joellen Fair. And her focus, she does international communication, and I took a seminar with her on media ethnographies in my second semester of graduate school in the spring of 2008. And she mostly studies African media and African cultural studies. So, you know, area studies-wise, it isn't necessarily the best match with what direction I've gone in, but she was a wonderful advisor. and definitely gave me the intellectual freedom to pursue what I wanted. What I did for my master's thesis is I did a case study of the Latin American Association of Radio Education, which is an association of community radio stations in Latin America. They have over 100 affiliates in 17 countries, and they're headquartered in Quito, Ecuador. So I actually got a small research grant from the Latin American, Caribbean, and Iberian Studies program, LACIS, here on campus to go do field work the summer after my first year of graduate school. So I spent 10 weeks in Quito working or doing participant observation research in the headquarters of ALAIR, it's the acronym for the organization, and then based my master's thesis on that. And she was very supportive of, you know, I think, you know, like I came to her, you know, having just started taking her class in January and you know, for advice about applying for this grant that was due in February. And she said she would write me a letter of recommendation and always had a lot of faith in my abilities to conduct, you know, the international field work for the first time. And I hadn't taken a methods course at all, you know, and said, oh, well, just read these couple books and you're going to be fine. And, you know, gave me advice throughout the process, both of conducting the research and also when I came back, you know, guiding me through the process of writing up the research.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So while you were pursuing the master's degree, were you thinking at that point about going on to get a terminal degree in something, or were you looking at the master's as a terminal degree that you would then apply into the workforce?
You know, I was thinking about both. I came back to graduate school thinking that I would pursue a PhD, but I did consider my second year of graduate school, leaving graduate school and applying for jobs. You know, that was around January, February of 2007. No, I guess this would have been end of 2008 going into 2009, right at the height of the economic recession. You know, and so then I thought to myself, well, graduate school's been really great, and you know, I feel so much smarter now, and I can think about things so differently, you know, and really expanded my boundaries as far as what I thought that I was capable of. For example, taking statistics, I ended up taking 4 semesters of statistics and, you know, came back to graduate school being completely fearful of something like that. And so pushing myself intellectually, but then I thought, well, what can I do with this? And that's, you know, that's the tension, I think, when you are taking an academic track, is how do you translate that into something that would be applicable skills outside of academia is challenging. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really feel like at that point, combined with the type of training that I got in graduate school, as well as the realities of the economic recession, that I would be able to find a job doing something that different than what I had been doing before, which had been working in nonprofit media fundraising. And so I ended up deciding, well, if I'm ever going to continue, I might as well do it now. This is the time to be in school, if any. So I ended up deciding to stay, and I switched to life sciences communication for a PhD. And the reason why I did that was mostly life sciences communication has a very applied approach to doing research that attracted me to that program. And there are also professors that do more international research. And there was a professor who is actually now in the journalism school, but who at the time was in life sciences communication, who did international research in Latin America. He's originally from Colombia and does projects there. And so there were kind of, I guess, the main reasons why I ended up deciding to finish the master's in journalism and then switch for the PhD as my academic home to life sciences communication.
Okay. A couple more things for today to sort of set the stage for our follow-up interview. So the first question is, were you involved in politics before February 2011?
Yes. You know, I have told you about how I was involved with the UW Greens as an undergraduate student and more around environmental issues and some with fair trade and food-related issues. You know, and then I feel that working in community and independent media is a form of politics and political engagement. Most people that are attracted to volunteering somewhere like WORT are people that are passionate about various activist issues, whether it be politics or social or economic issues, and they carry that passion into the coverage that they do. You know, and most people cover things that they are involved with activist-wise outside of media and outside of the radio station. So I always felt that working at WRT was a form of activism and community service, you know, working at the radio station. You know, when I first came back to graduate school, well, and I guess what I will mention briefly is I worked at the Progressive magazine before I came back to school for a couple years, and, you know, which is a social justice publication founded by Bob La Follette in 1909, you know, of course, a very big figure in Progressive era politics in Wisconsin. And so while working at the Progressive magazine, I worked as a union steward. So both at WRT, we actually were affiliated with SEIU, which is the Service Employees International Union, which mostly works with healthcare workers. You know, I've always, before coming back to graduate school, I worked at very small places. And so, but if they're social justice organizations, people running them feel like we should have a union. But then when you're only six people in your collective bargaining unit, it's very hard to find a union that will take you. And so, you know, at WRT, we had a union, and we were all involved in the process of negotiating a contract. But we were affiliated with SEIU, which is a little bit of an odd fit. And then I later worked at the Progressive magazine, and we also had a union there, and we were affiliated with the National Organization of Legal Service Workers, which is part of the United Auto Workers. So again, maybe a little bit of a odd fit. You know, so I had experience being involved with unions in a couple workplaces before I came back to graduate school. And I worked, and I was a union steward at the Progressive, and that was a very formative experience. I actually negotiated a couple grievances as a union steward while at the Progressive, which the details are irrelevant. But it was formative in the sense for me of seeing how important it is to have a voice in your workplace and be able to collectively represent yourselves, regardless of the type of workplace that is, mm-hmm. you know, that is important. Mm-hmm. And so I came back to graduate school in the fall of 2007. And, you know, I was not very involved in the TAA my first couple years of graduate school. You know, I joined the TAA. I did a little bit of volunteering my first year editing a newsletter. But I mostly, you know, I came back to school because I was really committed in advancing my own education. And so I focused most of my time and energy on that. So I got a little bit more involved with the TAA in the past year. So before February of 2011, I had been getting more involved with the TAA, and I had been a member for the previous few years and had past experience being involved with unions, but I wouldn't say that I was the most politically involved prior to February of 2011.
Well, you jumped my second question, which was to ask about your involvement in the TAA, which is what I was going to ask after. So you just mentioned that. I'm wondering though if there are things you want to add to. You say you became more involved in the TAA pre February 11, and you just talked about that a little bit. Is there anything else you want to add about your involvement in the TAA pre February 2011?
Well, you know, the longer I was in graduate school, and so this last year was my fourth year of graduate school. So towards the end of my third year of graduate school, I realized that I did want to spend more time doing things that weren't, I wanted to have some other kinds of outside activities, you know, that I wanted to be more involved in something else that wasn't just doing research. You know, after being in school for several years, you know, I have stayed involved with WRT a little bit. Not as much as I would ideally like, you know, but that I did want to do something outside of the classroom and outside of research. And so I started doing a little bit of volunteering with the TAA, not a whole lot, but the fall of my fourth year, so last year. And a friend and I actually decided, you know, we thought the TAA needed help with publicity. This is, and with the election last fall, I think everybody was worried about what was going to happen when Scott Walker became governor. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all very aware. And in December, you know, when You know, so I wasn't involved with negotiating the contract, but when the state employee unions negotiated contracts, and this is a piece that gets lost as people retell the history of what happened, that it was actually the Democrats, when they controlled both of the chambers and legislature and the governorship, failed to ratify. Doyle, you know, said he would have signed the contracts, but that they failed to approve our contracts, and the governor would have signed them. Of course, that would have only protected us until like July of this year. It would have only pushed things back maybe 6 months. But when that happened, you know, right around the end of the semester last fall, in December, all of a sudden there was a lot of concern about what was happening. So I think that was kind of setting the stage for, well, of course, we had no idea that there was going to be a Capitol occupation and mass protests. But, you know, in January, I went to a retreat, a TAA retreat, and, you know, we were very concerned about what was going on and planning. And that was where the idea for having the February 14th demonstration, the I Heart UW, Walker Don't Break My Heart demonstration, came out of that discussion in January over winter break, because we knew that there were going to be significant cuts to higher education funding in the budget, and we knew that he was supposed to announce the budget in the beginning of March, end of February, early March. So that's why we chose that day where we were planning that demonstration. And it was during that workshop, it was like I was there maybe 3 or 4 hours, and I kind of thought, oh, the TA needs help with publicity. And so, you know, another friend of mine who's a graduate student in the journalism school and I were talking, you know, and deciding that we wanted to help with publicity. And so we actually decided to restart the TAA publicity committee right before Walker announced the budget repair bill, and we had our first meeting. It would have been like the first or second week of February, you know, in advance of the February 14th demonstration. And we had a couple people that then wrote a press release, and I wrote an op-ed that was published in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about higher education funding, and Walker's big campaign promise was to create 250,000 jobs. And in his State of the State speech, he talked about this high-tech workforce that we need, and this global competition, you know, that we're facing, and then creating these 250,000 jobs, but then this disconnect between why are you cutting hundreds of millions of dollars from higher education when you're saying that you need a highly trained workforce? It just doesn't make any sense. And so we started doing a little bit of publicity work. It happened to be completely happenstance, you know, right before Walker announced the bill on the 11th of February. So that definitely positioned us well as far as doing media work for the TAA and what became the Capitol occupation.
Okay. We're at a point where, and this is more me than you, that I'm, I think it's a good stopping point for today. And I always try to leave the narrator with the last word, meaning is there anything that's, as you've been talking about this, is there anything on your mind? And it could be things happen after February 11th, but you would like to get on the record in case we don't get a chance to, you don't get a chance to talk about it either in the follow-up or if we do another interview. So basically, this is a chance for you to, if you got something on your mind, to get it off your chest before we close for today.
I guess there's one thing, you know, we talked at, so I think next time we'll talk more in detail about organizing for the TAA in February and March, and I had mentioned to you that I was involved with the media aspect of that and social media, and I know that was something that you wanted to talk about. But we talked at the beginning about, you asked about my family and growing up, and there was one thing that was a formative experience that I guess I wanted to mention that I haven't yet is, you know, I told you that my parents were teachers, and my mom was very involved in her union. She was on a bargaining team at one point. And I remember the first demonstration that I ever attended was with my mother. And it was this time when they were negotiating a contract. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. And they had a demonstration at the St. Paul School's administration building. And they ended up not going on strike. They made some kind of last minute deal. But I remember going with my mother to a demonstration where they were throwing old shoes into a pile, or they, you know, and the metaphor, the message that they were using is, you know, they're walking in a circle and just piling shoes in the lobby of the school district administration, because that, you know, they're trying to send this message that they were being walked all over. And I remember that demonstration, and I just remember walking in circles and throwing shoes in a pile. You know, I was very young at that point, but it was something that I thought back about. I reflected on some, in February and March with everything that was going on here, and talked with my mother about in the summer a little bit, and she said that it was really, so partly it was about economic issues, it was about raises, but what it was more about was about respect, and having respect for their labor as teachers, and the work that they did with children, and about just having respect in the workplace. And I think that that's the same thing that we've been fighting for here in Wisconsin, that the economic issues are important and they're affecting all of us who are state workers right now and will continue to do so, especially after January when there are additional co-pays for our health insurance. But the underlying issue to me is about respect.
Jill, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.